The tables were filling. The gaps were closing. Before long, some of the Phelans would be sitting close to each other. Ramble's mother, Tyra, brought two young men of about the same age. One had tight jeans and a hairy chest. The other was well-groomed in dark pinstripes. She was sleeping with the gigolo. The lawyer would get his on the back end. Another gap was filled. On the other side of the bar, the courtroom was alive with the hum of gossip and speculation. No wonder the old man jumped, one reporter said to another as they examined the Phelans. The Phelan grandchildren were forced to sit with the spectators and common folk. They huddled with their small entourages and support groups and giggled nervously as fate was about to swing their way. Libigail Jeter arrived with her husband, Spike, the 320-pound ex-biker, and they waddled down the aisle as out of place as anyone, though they'd seen their share of courtrooms. They followed Wally Bright, their Yellow Pages lawyer. Wally wore a spotted raincoat that dragged the floor, scuffed wingtips, and a polyester tie that was 20 years old, and if the spectators had voted right then, he would have easily won the award for the worst-dressed lawyer. He carried his papers in an expandable file, one that had been used for countless divorces and other matters. For some reason, Bright had never purchased a briefcase. He'd finished 10th in his class in night school. They went straight for the widest gap, and as they were taking their seats, Bright began the noisy process of removing his raincoat. The ragged hem of it brushed against the neck of one of Hark's nameless associates, an earnest young man already bothered by Bright's body odor. "If you don't mind," he said sharply, swinging a backhand toward Bright and missing. The words cracked through the tense and edgy air. Heads jerked around the tables as important documents were instantly ignored. Everybody hated everybody. "Sorry," Bright responded with great sarcasm. Two deputies moved forward to intervene if necessary. But the raincoat found a place under the table without further incident, and Bright finally managed to seat himself next to Libigail, with Spike sitting on the other side, stroking his beard and staring at Troy Jr. as if he'd love to slap him. Few people in the courtroom expected the brief skirmish to be the last among the Phelans. "You die with $11 billion, and people care about your last will and testament, especially if there's a chance that one of the world's great fortunes is about to be fed to the vultures." The tabloids were there, along with the local papers and all the important financial magazines. The three rows Wycliffe had designated for the press were full by 9:30. The journalist had a delightful time watching the Phelans gather in front of them. Three artists worked feverishly. The panorama before them was rich with inspiration. The punk with the green hair received more than his share of sketches. Josh Stafford made his appearance at 9:50. Tip Durbin was with him, along with two other members of the firm and a couple of paralegals to round out the team. Stern and somber-faced, they took seats at their table, a rather spacious one compared to the cramped quarters holding all the Phelans and all their lawyers. Josh placed a single thick file in front of him, and all eyes were immediately upon it. Inside was what appeared to be a document, almost 2 inches thick, and very similar to what old Troy had signed on video just 19 days earlier. They couldn't help staring at it, everyone but Ramble. Virginia law allowed heirs to receive early distributions if the estate was liquid and there was no concern about the payment of debts and taxes. Estimates from the Phelan lawyers ranged from a low of $10 million per heir all the way to Bright's guess of $50 million. Bright, in his entire life, had never seen $50,000. At 10, the deputies locked the doors, and upon some unseen cue, Judge Wycliffe emerged from an opening behind the bench, and the room was silent. He eased into the chair, his crisp robe settling around him, and smiled. "Good morning," he said into the microphone. Everyone smiled back. To his great satisfaction, the room was filled to capacity. A quick deputy count revealed 8, armed and ready. He studied the Phelans. There were no gaps left. Some of their lawyers were practically touching one another. "Are all of the parties present?" he asked. Heads shook from around the tables. "I need to identify everyone," he said, reaching for papers. The first petition was filed by Rex Phelan. Before the word settled, Hart Geddes was on his feet, clearing his throat. "Your Honor, I'm Hart Geddes," he boomed toward the bench, "and I represent Mr. Rex Phelan." "Thank you. You may keep your seat." He went around the tables, methodically taking names of the heirs and the lawyers. All the lawyers. The reporters scribbled them as fast as the judge. 6 heirs in all, 3 ex-wives. Everyone was present. 22 lawyers, Wycliffe mumbled to himself. "Do you have the will, Mr. Stafford?" he asked. Josh stood, holding a different file.
"I do."
"Would you please take the witness stand?" Josh made his way around the tables and passed the court reporter to the witness stand, where he raised his right hand and swore to tell the truth. "You represented Troy Phelan?" Wycliffe asked.
"I did, for a number of years."
"Did you prepare a will for him?"
"I prepared several."
"Did you prepare his last will?" There was a pause, and as it grew longer, the Phelans inched closer.
"No, I did not," Josh said slowly, looking at the vultures.
The words were soft, but they cut through the air like thunder. The Phelan lawyers reacted much more quickly than the Phelan heirs, several of whom weren't sure what to make of it. But it was serious and unexpected. Another layer of tension settled around the tables. The courtroom grew even quieter. "Who prepared his last will and testament?" Wycliffe asked, like a bad actor reading a script.
"Mr. Phelan himself."
It wasn't so. They had seen the old man sit at the table with lawyers all around him and the 3 shrinks, Zadel, Flo, and Thetian, directly across the table. He'd been declared sane on the spot, and seconds later had taken a thick will prepared by Stafford and one of his associates, declared it to be his, and signed it. There was no dispute about this.
"Oh, my God," Hart Geddes said, under his breath but loud enough for everyone to hear.
"When did he sign it?" Wycliffe asked.
"Moments before he jumped to his death."
"Is it handwritten?"
"It is."
"Did he sign it in your presence?"
"He did. There were other witnesses. The signing was also videotaped."
"Please hand me the will." Josh deliberately withdrew a single envelope from the file and passed it up to His Honor. It looked awfully small. There was no way it contained enough language to convey to the Phelans what was rightfully theirs.
"What the hell is this?"
Troy Jr. hissed at the nearest lawyer. But the lawyer couldn't respond. The envelope held only 1 sheet of yellow paper. Wycliffe removed it slowly for all to see, unfolded it carefully, then studied it for a moment. Panic seized the Phelans, but there was nothing they could do. Had the old man screwed them 1 last time? Was the money slipping away? Maybe he had changed his mind and given them even more. Around the tables, they nudged and elbowed their lawyers, all of whom were remarkably quiet. Wycliffe cleared his throat and leaned a bit closer to the microphone. "I'm holding here a 1-page document purporting to be a will handwritten by Troy Phelan. I will read it straight through. The last testament of Troy L. Phelan. I, Troy L. Phelan, being of sound and disposing mind and memory, do hereby expressly revoke all former wills and codicils executed by me, and dispose of my estate as follows. To my children, Troy Phelan Jr., Rex Phelan, Libigail Jeter, Mary Ross Jackman, Gina Strong, and Ramble Phelan, I give each a sum of money necessary to pay off all the debts of each as of today. Any debts incurred after today will not be covered by this gift. If any of these children attempt to contest this will, then this gift shall be nullified as to that child." Even Ramble heard the words and understood them. Gina and Cody started crying softly.
Rex leaned forward, elbows on the table, face buried in his hands, his mind numb. Libigale looked past Bright to Spike and said, "That son of a bitch!" Spike concurred. Mary Ross covered her eyes as her lawyer rubbed her knee. Her husband rubbed the other one. Only Troy Jr. managed a poker face, but not for much longer. There was more damage yet to come. Wycliffe wasn't finished. "To my ex-wives, Lillian, Janie, and Tyra, I give nothing. They were adequately provided for in the divorces." At that moment, Lillian, Janie, and Tyra were wondering what the hell they were doing in the courtroom. Had they really expected to receive more cash from a man they hated? They felt the stares and tried to hide among their lawyers. The reporters and journalists were downright giddy. They wanted to take notes, but they were afraid of missing a single word. Some couldn't help but grin. "The remainder of my estate I give to my daughter, Rachel Lane, born on November 2, 1954, at Catholic Hospital in New Orleans, Louisiana, to a woman named Evelyn Cunningham, now deceased." Wycliffe paused, though not for dramatic effect. With only two small paragraphs left, the damage was done. The $11 billion had been given to an illegitimate heir he'd not read about. The Phelans sitting before him had been stripped. He couldn't help but look at them. "I appoint my trusted lawyer, Joshua Stafford, as executor of this will, and grant unto him broad discretionary powers in its administration." For the moment, they had forgotten about Josh. But there he sat, in the box, like the innocent witness of a car wreck, and they glared at him with as much hatred as possible. How much had he known? Was he a conspirator? No doubt he could have done something to prevent this. Josh fought to keep a straight face. "This document is intended to be a holographic will. Every word has been written by my hand, and I hereby sign it." Wycliffe lowered it and said, "The testament was signed by Troy L. Phelan at 3 p.m. on December 9, 1996. He laid it down and looked around the courtroom, the epicenter. The quake was ending, and now it was time for the aftershocks. The Phelans sat low in their seats, some rubbing eyes and foreheads, others staring wildly at the walls. For the moment, all 22 lawyers were incapable of speech. The shocks rippled through the rows of spectators, where, oddly, a few smiles could be seen. Ah, it was the media, suddenly anxious to race from the room and start reporting. Amber sobbed loudly, then caught herself. She'd met Troy only once, and he'd made a crude advance. Her grief was not for the loss of a loved one. Gina cried quietly, as did Mary Ross. Libigale and Spike chose to curse instead. "Don't worry," Bright said, waving them off as if he could remedy this injustice in a matter of days. Biff glared at Troy Jr., and the seeds of a divorce were planted. Since the suicide, he'd been especially arrogant and condescending to her. She'd tolerated it for obvious reasons, but no longer. She relished the first fight, one that would no doubt begin just a few feet outside the courtroom doors. Other seeds were planted. For the thick-skinned lawyers, the surprise was received, absorbed, then shaken off, as instinctively as a duck shakes off water. They were about to get rich. Their clients were heavily in debt, with no relief in sight. They had no choice but to contest the will. Litigation would rage for years. "When do you anticipate probating the will?" Wycliffe asked Josh.
"Within a week."
"Very well, you may step down." Josh returned to his seat, triumphant, as the lawyers began shuffling papers and pretending everything was fine. "We are adjourned." Chapter 19. There were three fights in the hallway after adjournment. Fortunately, none involved Phelans fighting Phelans. Those would come later. A mob of reporters waited outside the courtroom doors as the Phelans were consoled inside by their lawyers. Troy Jr. was the first to exit, and he was immediately surrounded by a pack of wolves, several with microphones in the attack position. He was hung over to begin with, and now that he was $500 million poorer, he was in no mood to talk about his father. "Are you surprised?" some idiot asked from behind a microphone. "Damned right," he said, trying to walk through the group. "Who is Rachel Lane?" asked another. "I guess she's my sister," he snapped. A skinny little boy with stupid eyes and a bad complexion stopped directly in front of him, thrust a tape recorder in his face, and asked, "How many illegitimate children did your father have?" Troy Jr. instinctively shoved the tape recorder back at him. It landed sharply just above his nose, and as he fell back, Troy Jr. launched a wild left hook that popped him in the ear and knocked him down. In the commotion, a deputy pushed Troy Jr. in another direction, and they made a quick escape. Ramble spit on another reporter, who had to be restrained by a colleague who reminded him the kid was underage. The third skirmish happened when Libigale and Spike lumbered out of the courtroom behind Wally Bright. "No comment," Bright yelled at the horde closing ranks around them. "No comment, please get out of the way." Libigale, who was crying, tripped over a TV cable and tumbled into a reporter, who also fell. There were shouts and curses, and as the reporter was on all fours and getting to his feet, Spike kicked him in the ribs. He squealed and fell flat again, and as he was thrashing about trying to get up, his foot caught the edge of Libigale's dress, and she slapped him for good measure. Spike was about to slaughter him when a deputy intervened. Deputies broke up each fight, always siding with the Phelans over the reporters. They helped rush the beleaguered heirs and their lawyers down the stairs, through the lobby, and out of the building. Lawyer Grit, who represented Mary Ross Phelan Jackman, was overcome by the sight of so many reporters. The First Amendment seized him, or at least his own rudimentary understanding of it, and he felt compelled to speak freely. With his arm around his distraught client, he grimly offered their reaction to the surprise will. It was obviously the work of a demented man. How else could you explain the passing of such a great fortune to an unknown heir? His client adored her father, loved him deeply, worshipped him, and as Grit babbled on and on about the incredible love between father and daughter, Mary Ross finally took the hint and began crying. Grit himself appeared on the verge of tears. Yes, they would fight. They would battle this grave injustice to the U.S. Supreme Court. Why? Because this was not the work of the Troy Phelan they knew. Bless his heart. He loved his children, and they loved him. Theirs was an incredible bond forged through tragedy and hardship. They would fight because their beloved father was not himself when he scribbled this ghastly document. Josh Stafford was in no hurry to leave. He spoke quietly to Hart Geddes and some of the attorneys from the other tables. He promised to send them copies of the hideous will. Things were initially cordial, but hostilities were growing by the minute. A reporter he knew from the Post was waiting in the hall, and Josh spent 10 minutes with him while saying nothing. Of particular interest was Rachel Lane, her history and whereabouts. There were lots of questions, but Josh had no answers. Surely Nate would find her before anyone else. The story grew. It shot from the courthouse on the waves of the latest telecommunications gadgets and high-tech hardware. The reporters scrambled with cell phones and laptops and pagers, talking without thinking. The major wires began running the news 20 minutes after adjournment, and an hour later the first round-the-clock news gabathon broke into its running series of repetitive stories to go live to a reporter in front of a camera outside the courthouse. "Stunning news here," she began, and then told the story, getting most of it right. Seated in the rear of the courtroom was Pat Solomon, the last person selected by Troy to run the Phelan Group. He'd been CEO for 6 years, 6 very uneventful and very profitable years. He left the courthouse without being recognized by any reporter. As he rode away in the back of his limo, Solomon attempted to analyze Troy's last bombshell. He was not shocked by it. After working for Troy for 20 years, nothing surprised him. The reaction of his idiot children and their lawyers was comforting. Solomon had once been assigned the impossible task of finding within the company a job that Troy Jr. could perform without causing a dip in quarterly profits. It had been a nightmare. Spoiled, immature, badly educated, and lacking basic management skills, Troy Jr. had run roughshod through an entire division in minerals before Solomon was given the green light from above to sack him. A few years later, a similar episode involved Rex and his pursuit of his father's approval and money. In the end, Rex had gone to Troy in an effort to remove Solomon. The wives and other children had butted in for years, but Troy had held fast. His private life was a fiasco, but nothing hampered his beloved company. Solomon and Troy had never been close. In fact, no one, perhaps with the exception of Josh Stafford, had ever managed to become a confidant. The parade of blondes had shared the obvious intimacies, but Troy had no friends. And as he withdrew and declined, both physically and mentally, those who ran the company sometimes whispered about its ownership. Surely Troy would not leave it to his children. He hadn't, at least not the usual suspects. The board was waiting on the 14th floor in the same conference room where Troy had produced his testament, then taken flight. Solomon described the scene in the courtroom, and his colorful narrative became humorous. Thoughts of the heirs gaining control had caused great discomfort among the board. Troy Jr. had let it be known that he and his siblings had the votes to seize a majority, and that he planned to clean house and show some real profits. They wanted to know about Janie, wife number two. She'd worked for the company as a secretary until her promotion to mistress, then to wife, and after reaching the top, she had been particularly abusive to many of the employees. Troy banned her from the corporate headquarters. When she left, she was crying, Solomon said happily. And Rex? Asked a director, the chief financial officer, who had once been fired by Rex in an elevator. Not a happy boy. He's under investigation, you know. They talked about most of the children and all of the wives, and the meeting grew festive. I counted 22 lawyers, Solomon said with a smile. Talk about a sad bunch. Since it was an informal board meeting, Josh's absence was of no consequence. The head of legal declared the will to be a stroke of great luck after all. They had to worry about only one unknown heir, as opposed to six idiots. Any idea where this woman is? None, answered Solomon. Maybe Josh knows. By late afternoon, Josh had been forced from his office and had retreated to a small library in the basement of his building. His secretary stopped counting phone messages at 120. The lobby off the main entrance had been crammed with reporters since late morning. He left behind strict instructions with his secretaries that no one should disturb him for an hour. So the knock on the door was especially aggravating. "Who is it?" he shot at the door.
"It's an emergency, sir," answered a secretary.
"Come in." Her head entered just far enough to look him in the face and say,
"It's Mr. O'Reilly."
Josh stopped rubbing his temples and actually smiled. He glanced around the room and remembered there were no phones. She took two steps and placed a portable on the table, then disappeared. "Nate," he said into the receiver. "That you, Josh?" came the reply. The volume was fine, but the words were a little scratchy. The reception was better than most car phones. "Yes, can you hear me, Nate?"
"Yes."
"Where are you?"
"I'm on the satellite on the back of my little yacht, floating down the Paraguay River. Can you hear me?"
"Yes, fine. Are you okay, Nate?"
"I'm wonderful, having a ball. Just a little boat trouble."
"What kind of trouble?"
"Well, the propeller snagged a line of old rope and the engine choked down. My crew is attempting to unravel it. I'm supervising."
"You sound great."
"It's an adventure, right, Josh?"
"Of course. Any sign of the girl?"
"Not a chance. We're a couple of days away at best, and now we're floating backward. I'm not sure we'll ever get there.
You have to, Nate. We read the will this morning in open court. The whole world will soon be looking for Rachel Lane.
I wouldn't worry about that. She's safe.
I wish I were with you.
The edge of a cloud nipped the signal.
What did you say?
Nate asked, louder.
Nothing. So you'll see her in a couple of days, huh?
If we're lucky. The boat runs around the clock, but we're going upriver and it's the rainy season, so the rivers are full and the currents are strong. Plus, we're not exactly sure where we're going. 2 days is very optimistic, assuming we get the damn propeller fixed.
So the weather's bad, Josh said, almost at random. There wasn't much to discuss. Nate was alive and well and moving in the general direction of the target.
It's hot as hell, and it rains 5 times a day. Other than that, it's lovely.
Any snakes?
A couple. Anacondas, longer than the boat. Lots of alligators. Rats as big as dogs. They call them capybaras. They live at the edge of the rivers among the alligators, and when these people get hungry enough, they kill them and eat them.
But you have plenty of food.
Oh, yes. Our cargo is black beans and rice. Welly cooks them for me 3 times a day.
Nate's voice was sharp and filled with adventure.
Who's Welly?
My deckhand. Right now he's under the boat in 12 feet of water, holding his breath and cutting rope from the prop. Like I said, I'm supervising.
Stay out of the water, Nate.
Are you kidding? I'm on the upper deck. Look, I gotta run. I'm using juice and I haven't found a way to recharge these batteries.
When will you call again?
I'll try and wait until after I find Rachel Lane.
Good idea. But call if you have trouble.
Trouble? Why would I call you, Josh? There's not a damn thing in the world you can do.
You're right. Don't call.
Chapter 20. The storm hit at dusk, as Welly was boiling rice in the kitchen and Jevy was watching the river grow dark. The wind woke Nate, a sudden howling blast that shook the hammock and snapped him to his feet. Thunder and lightning followed. He walked to Jevy's side and looked north into a vast blackness.
A big storm, Jevy said, seemingly indifferent.
Shouldn't we park this thing, Nate thought, at least find shallow water? Jevy didn't appear concerned. His nonchalance was somewhat comforting. When the rain started, Nate went below for his rice and beans. He ate in silence, with Welly in the corner of the cabin. The bulb above them swayed as the wind rocked the boat. Heavy raindrops battered the windows. On the bridge, Jevy put on a yellow poncho stained with grease and fought the rain, hitting him sharply in the face. The tiny wheelhouse had no windows. The 2 floodlights attempted to show the way through the darkness, but revealed no more than 50 feet of churning water in front of them. Jevy knew the river well, and he'd been through worse storms. Reading was difficult with the boat swaying and rolling. After a few minutes of it, Nate felt sick. In his bag, he found a knee-length poncho with a hood. Josh had thought of everything. Clutching the railings, he slowly made his way up the stairs, where Welly sat huddled next to the wheelhouse, drenched. The river bent to the east, toward the heart of the Pantanal, and when they turned, the wind caught them broadside. The boat rocked and threw Nate and Welly hard into the railings. Jevy braced himself with the door of the wheelhouse, his thick arms holding himself in place and maintaining control. The gusts became relentless, one after the other, only seconds apart, and the Santa Laura stopped moving upstream. The storm shoved it toward shore. The rain pellets were hard and cold now and poured down upon them in sheets. Jevy found a long flashlight in a box beside the wheel and gave it to Welly.
"Find the bank!"
he yelled, his voice struggling over the howling wind and heavy rain. Nate grappled along the railings to a spot next to Welly because he too wanted to see where they might be headed. But the beam caught nothing but rain so thick it looked like fog swirling above the water. Then lightning came to their aid. A flash, and they saw the dense black growth of the riverbank not far away. The wind was pushing them toward it.
Welly shouted, and Chevy yelled something back, just as another gust slammed into the boat and tipped it violently to its starboard side. The sudden jolt knocked the flashlight out of Welly's hand, and they watched it disappear into the water. Crouched on the walkway, clutching the railing, soaked and shivering, it occurred to Nate that one of two things was about to happen, and neither was within their control. First, the boat was going to capsize. If it didn't, then they were about to be shoved into the side of the river, into the quagmire where the reptiles lived. He was only slightly scared until he thought about the papers. Under no circumstances could the papers be lost. He suddenly stood just as the boat tipped again, and he almost went over the rail. "I have to go below," he yelled to Chevy, who was gripping the wheel. The captain was scared, too. With his back to the wind, Nate crept down the grated steps. The deck was slick with diesel fuel. A drum had tipped over and was leaking. He tried to lift it, but it would take two men. He ducked into the cabin, flung his poncho in a corner, and went for his briefcase under the cot. The wind slammed into the boat. It pitched and caught Nate with his hands free. He landed hard against the wall with his feet above his head. There were two things he couldn't lose, he decided. First, the papers. Second, the sat phone. Both were in the briefcase, which was new and nice, but certainly not waterproof. He clutched it across his chest and lay on his bunk while the Santa Laura rode out the storm. The knocking stopped. He hoped Chevy had killed the engine with a switch. He could hear their footsteps directly above him. "We're about to hit the bank," he thought, "and it's best for the prop to be disengaged. Surely it wasn't engine trouble." The lights went out. Complete darkness. Lying there in the dark, swaying with the pitch and roll, waiting for the Santa Laura to crash into the riverbank, Nate had a horrible thought. If she refused to sign the acknowledgement and/or the waiver, a return trip might be necessary. Months down the road, or maybe years, someone, probably Nate himself, would be forced to trek back up the Paraguay and inform the world's richest missionary that things were finalized and the money was hers. He had read that missionaries took furloughs, long breaks in their work when they returned to the States and recharged their batteries. Why couldn't Rachel take a furlough, maybe even fly home with him, and hang around long enough for Daddy's mess to get cleaned up? For $11 billion, that seemed the least she could do. He'd suggest it to her, if he ever got the chance to meet her. There was a crash, and Nate was tossed to the floor. They were in the brush. The Santa Laura was flat-bottomed, built, like all the boats in the Pantanal, to scrape across sandbars and take the hits of river debris. After the storm, Chevy started the engine, and for half an hour worked the boat back and forth, slowly dislodging it from the sand and mud. When they were free, Welly and Nate cleared the deck of limbs and brush. Their search of the boat found no new passengers, no snakes or jacarés. During a quick coffee break, Chevy told the story of an anaconda that had found its way on board years ago, attacked a sleeping deckhand. Nate said he didn't particularly care for snake stories. His search was slow and deliberate. The clouds went away and a beautiful half-moon appeared above the river. Welly brewed a pot of coffee. After the violence of the storm, the Pantanal seemed determined to be perfectly still. The river was as smooth as glass. The moon guided them, disappearing when they turned with the river, but always there when they headed north again. Because Nate was half Brazilian now, he wore no wristwatch. Time mattered little. It was late, probably midnight. The rain had battered them for 4 hours. Nate slept a few hours in the hammock and awakened just after dawn. He found Chevy snoring on his bunk in the tiny cabin behind the wheelhouse. Welly was at the wheel, himself half asleep. Nate sent him for coffee and took the helm of the Santa Laura. The clouds were back, but no rain was in sight. The river was littered with limbs and leaves, the rubble and remains from last night's storm. It was wide, and there was no traffic, so Nate the skipper sent Welly to the hammock for a nap, while he commanded the vessel. It beat the hell out of a courtroom. Shirtless, shoeless, sipping sweet coffee while leading an expedition into the heart of the world's largest swamp. In the glory days, he would have been racing to a trial somewhere, juggling 10 things at once, phones stuck in every pocket. He didn't really miss it. No lawyer in his right mind really missed the courtroom. But he would never admit that. The boat practically guided itself. With Jevy's binoculars, he watched the shoreline for jacarés, snakes, and capivaras. And he counted to Iuius, the tall, white, long-necked bird with a red head that had become the symbol of the Pantanal. There were 12 in one flock on a sandbar. They stood still and watched the boat go by. The captain and his sleepy crew steamed northward as the sky turned orange and the day began. Deeper and deeper into the Pantanal, uncertain where their journey would lead them. Chapter 21. The coordinator of South American missions was a woman named Neva Collier. She was born in an igloo in Newfoundland, where her parents had worked for 20 years among the Inuit natives. She herself had spent 11 years working in the mountains of New Guinea, so she knew firsthand the trials and challenges of the 900 or so people whose activity she coordinated. And she was the only person who knew that Rachel Porter had once been Rachel Lane, illegitimate daughter of Troy Phelan. After med school, Rachel had changed names in an effort to erase as much of her past as possible. She had no family. Both adoptive parents had died. No siblings, no aunts, uncles, or cousins, at least none that she knew. She had only Troy, and she was desperate to remove him from her life. After completing the World Tribe Seminary, Rachel had confided her secrets to Neva Collier. The higher-ups at World Tribes knew Rachel had secrets, but not a history that would impede her yearning to serve God. She was a doctor, a graduate of their seminary, a dedicated and humble servant of Christ, who was eager to enter the mission field. They promised never to divulge anything about Rachel, including her exact location in South America. Sitting in her small, neat office in Houston, Neva read the extraordinary account of the reading of Mr. Phelan's will. She had been following the story since the suicide. Communication with Rachel was a slow process. They exchanged mail twice a year, in March and in August, and Rachel usually called once a year from a payphone in Corumbá when she went there for supplies. Neva had spoken to her the year before. Her last furlough had been in 1992. After 6 weeks, she'd abandoned it and returned to the Pantanal. She had no interest in being in the U.S., she had confided in Neva. It was not her home. She belonged with her people. Judging from the lawyer's comments in the article, the issue was far from settled. Neva put the file away and decided to wait. At the appropriate time, whenever that might be, she would inform her governing board of Rachel's old identity. She hoped that moment would never come. But how exactly does one hide $11 billion? No one really expected the lawyers to agree on where to meet. Each firm insisted on choosing the site of the summit. The fact that they agreed to actually get together on such short notice was monumental. So they met at a hotel, the Ritz in Tyson's Corner, in a banquet room where tables had been hastily wedged together in a perfect square. When the door was finally closed, there were close to 50 people in the room, for every firm felt obliged to bring along extra associates and paralegals and even secretaries to impress. The tension was almost visible. No Phelans were present, only their legal teams. Hart Geddes called the meeting to order and did the wise thing of cracking a very funny joke.
Like humor in the courtroom, where people were anxious and not expecting comedy, the laughter was loud and healthy. He suggested they go around the table and let one lawyer per Phelan heir say what was on his or her mind. He would go last. An objection was lodged. Who exactly are the heirs?
The 6 Phelan children,
Hark responded.
What about the 3 wives?
They're not heirs, they're ex-wives. This upset the attorneys for the wives, and after a heated battle, they threatened to walk out. Someone suggested allowing them to speak anyway, and this solved the problem. Grit, the feisty litigator hired by Mary Ross Phelan Jackman and her husband, stood and made a plea for war.
We have no choice but to challenge the will, he said. There was no undue influence, so we have to prove the old buzzard was crazy. Hell, he jumped to his death. And he gave one of the world's great fortunes to some unknown heir. Sounds crazy to me. We can find psychiatrists who'll testify.
What about the 3 who examined him before he jumped? Someone shot from across the table.
That was stupid, Grit snarled back. It was a setup and you guys fell for it.
This upset Hark and the other lawyers who had agreed on the mental exam.
Perfect hindsight, Yancey said, and that stalled Grit for the moment.
The legal team for Gina and Cody Strong was headed by a woman named Langhorn, who was tall and thick and wore an Armani dress. She had once been a professor at Georgetown Law, and when she addressed the group, she did so with the air of one who knew everything. Point 1. There were only 2 grounds for contesting a will in Virginia, undue influence and lack of mental capacity. Since no one knew Rachel Lane, it was safe to assume she had little or no contact with Troy. Therefore, it would be difficult, if not impossible, to prove she somehow unduly influenced him when he made his last will. Point 2. Lack of testamentary capacity was their only hope. Point 3. Forget fraud. Sure, he lured them into the mental exam under false pretenses, but a will cannot be attacked on the grounds of fraud. A contract, yes, a will, no. They had already done the research, and she had the cases if anyone cared. She worked from a brief of some sort and was impeccably prepared. No less than 6 others from her firm huddled behind her in support. Point 4, the mental exam would be very difficult to crack. She'd seen the video. They would probably lose the war, but they could get paid for the battle. Her conclusion? Challenge the will with a fury and hope for a lucrative out-of-court settlement. Her lecture lasted for 10 minutes and covered little new ground. She was tolerated without interruption because she was female and the chip was almost visible. Wally Bright, he of the night school, was next, and in sharp contrast to Ms. Langhorn, he raged and railed at injustice in general. Nothing was prepared. No brief, no notes, no thoughts about what he would say next. Just a lot of hot air by a lawyer who perpetually flew by the seat of his pants. 2 of Lillian's lawyers stood at the same time and appeared to be joined at the hip. Both wore black suits and had the pale faces of estate lawyers who rarely saw the sun. One would start a sentence, and the other would finish it. One would ask a rhetorical question, the other had the answer. One mentioned a file, the other pulled it from a briefcase. The tag team was efficient, to the point, and repeated in succinct fashion what had already been said. A consensus was quickly emerging. Fight, for A, there was little to lose, B, there was nothing else to do, and C, it was the only way to force a settlement. Not to mention D, wherein they would get paid handsomely by the hour for fighting. Yancey was particularly forceful in urging the use of litigation. And rightly so. Ramble was the only minor among the heirs and had no debts to speak of. The trust that would pay him $5 million on his 21st had been established decades earlier and could not be revoked. With $5 million guaranteed, Ramble was in far better shape financially than any of his siblings. With nothing to lose, why not sue for more? An hour passed before someone mentioned the contest clause in the will. The heirs, excluding Ramble, ran the risk of losing what little Troy left them if they contested the will. This issue was given slight treatment by the lawyers. They had already decided to fight the will,
and they knew their greedy clients would follow their advice. A lot was not being said. The litigation would be cumbersome to begin with. The wisest and most cost-efficient course would be to select one firm with experience to act as chief trial counsel. The others could take a step back, still protect their clients, and be kept abreast of every development. Such a strategy would require two things. One, cooperation, and two, the voluntary downsizing of most of the egos in the room. It was never mentioned during the three-hour meeting. Through no grand scheme of their own, schemes require cooperation, the lawyers had managed to divide the heirs so that no two shared the same firm. Through skillful manipulation that is not taught in law school but acquired naturally thereafter, the lawyers had convinced the clients to spend more time talking to them than to their fellow heirs. Trust was not a virtue known to the Phelans nor to their attorneys. It was shaping up to be one long, chaotic lawsuit. Not one brave voice suggested the will be left alone. There was not the slightest interest in following the wishes of the man who'd actually made the fortune they now conspired to carve up. During the third or fourth trip around the tables, an effort was made to determine the level of debt held by each of the six heirs at the time of Mr. Phelan's death, but the effort fizzled under a barrage of legal nitpicking. "Are the debts of spouses included?" asked Hark, attorney for Rex, whose wife Amber the stripper owned the skin clubs and had her name on most of the debts. "What about obligations to the IRS?" asked the attorney for Troy Jr., who had been having tax trouble for 15 years. "My clients have not authorized me to divulge financial information," said Langhorn, who with that dire declaration effectively iced the issue. The reluctance confirmed what everybody knew. The Phelan heirs were up to their ears in loans and mortgages. All the lawyers, being lawyers, were deeply concerned about publicity and how their fight would be portrayed by the media. Their clients were not simply a bunch of spoiled, greedy children who'd been cut out by their father, but they feared the press might take this posture. Perceptions were crucial. "I suggest we hire a public relations firm," Hark announced. It was a wonderful idea, one that several others immediately seized as their own. Hire a pro to paint the Phelan heirs as the broken-hearted children who'd loved a man who had little time for them. An eccentric, philandering, half-crazy, yes, that was it, make Troy the bad guy and make their clients the victims. The idea bloomed and the fiction spread happily around the tables until someone asked just exactly how they would pay for such services. "They're horribly expensive," said a lawyer, who happened to be charging $600 an hour for himself and $400 an hour for each of his three useless associates. The idea lost steam quickly until Hark offered the lame suggestion that each firm could front some expense money. The meeting grew incredibly quiet. Those who'd had so much to say about everything were now captivated by the magical language of briefs and old cases. "We can talk about this later," Hark said, attempting to save face. No doubt the idea would never be mentioned again. They then discussed Rachel and where she might be. Should they retain a top-notch security firm to locate her? Almost every lawyer happened to know one. The idea was quite appealing and received more attention than it should have. What lawyer wouldn't want to represent the chosen heir? But they decided against looking for Rachel, primarily because they couldn't agree on what they would do if they found her. She would surface soon enough, no doubt with her own entourage of lawyers. The meeting ended on a pleasant note. The lawyers gave themselves the outcome they wanted. They left with plans to immediately call their clients and proudly report how much progress was made. They could say unequivocally that it was the combined wisdom of all the Phelan lawyers that the will should be attacked with a vengeance. Chapter 22. The river rose throughout the day,
slowly leaving its banks, in some places swallowing sandbars, rising into the thick brush, flooding the small, muddy yards of houses they passed once every 3 hours. The river carried more and more debris, weeds and grass, limbs and saplings. As it grew wider, it grew stronger, and the currents running against the boat slowed them even more. But no one was watching the clock. Nate had been politely relieved of his captain's duties after the Santa Laura was struck by a wayward tree trunk, one he never saw. No damage, but the jolt sent Chevy and Welly scurrying to the wheelhouse. He returned to his own little deck with a hammock stretched through the center, and there he spent the morning reading and watching wildlife. Chevy joined him for coffee. "So what do you think of the Pantanal?" he asked. They sat next to each other on a bench with their arms through the railing and their bare feet dangling over the side of the boat. "It's pretty magnificent. Do you know Colorado?"
"I've been there, yes."
"During the rainy season, the rivers in the Pantanal overflow. The flooded area is the size of Colorado."
"Have you been to Colorado?"
"Yes, I have a cousin there."
"Where else have you been?"
3 years ago, my cousin and I rode a big bus, a Greyhound, across the country. We were in every state but six."
Chevy was a poor Brazilian boy of 24. Nate was twice his age and for most of his career had had plenty of money. Yet Chevy had seen much more of the U.S. than Nate. When the money was good, though, Nate had always traveled to Europe. His favorite restaurants were in Rome and Paris.
"When the floods stop," Chevy continued, "we have the dry season. Grasslands, marshes, more lagoons and swamps than anyone can count. The cycle, the flooding, and the dry season produces more wildlife than any place in the world. We have 650 species of birds here, more than Canada and the U.S. combined. At least 260 species of fish, snakes, caiman, alligators, even giant otters live in the water."
As if on cue, he pointed to a thicket at the edge of a small forest.
"Look, it's a deer," he said. "We have lots of deer, and lots of jaguars, giant anteaters, capybaras, tapirs, and macaws. The Pantanal is filled with wildlife."
"You were born here?"
"I took my first breath in the hospital in Corumbá, but I was born on these rivers. This is my home."
"You told me your father was a river pilot."
"Yes. When I was a small boy, I began going with him. Early in the morning, when everybody was asleep, he would allow me to take the wheel. I knew all the main rivers by the time I was 10.
"And he died on the river?"
"Not this, but the Taquari, to the east. He was guiding a boat of German tourists when a storm hit them. The only survivor was a deckhand."
"When was this?"
5 years ago."
Forever the trial lawyer, Nate had a dozen more questions about the accident. He wanted the details. Details win lawsuits. But he said, "I'm sorry," and let it go.
"They want to destroy the Pantanal," Chevy said.
"Who?"
"Lots of people. Big companies that own big farms. To the north and east of the Pantanal, they are clearing large sections of land for farms. The main crop is soja, which you call soybeans. They want to export it. The more forests they clear, the more runoff collects in the Pantanal. Sediment rises each year in our rivers. Their farm soil is not good, so the companies use many sprays and fertilizers to grow crops. We get the chemicals. Many of the big farms dam up rivers to create new pastures. This upsets the flooding cycle. And mercury is killing our fish."
"How does mercury get here?"
"Mining. To the north, they mine gold, and they do it with mercury. It runs into the rivers eventually run into the Pantanal. Our fish swallow it and die. Everything is dumped into the Pantanal. Cuiabá is a city of 1 million people to the east. It has no waste treatment. Guess where its sewage goes?"
"Doesn't the government help?"
Chevy managed a bitter laugh. "Have you heard of Hidrovia?"
"No."
"It's a big ditch to be cut through the Pantanal. It's supposed to link Brazil, Bolivia, Paraguay, Argentina, and Uruguay. It is supposed to save South America.
but he will drain the Pantanal, and our government is supporting it.
Nate almost said something pious about environmental responsibility, then remembered that his countrymen were the biggest energy hogs the world had ever seen.
It's still beautiful, he said.
It is.
Chevy finished his coffee.
Sometimes I think it's too big for them to destroy.
They passed a narrow inlet where more water entered the Paraguay. A small herd of deer waded through the floodwaters, nibbling at green vines, oblivious to the noise from the river. 7 deer, 2 of which were spotted fawns.
There is a small trading post a few hours away, Chevy said, getting to his feet. We should be there before dark.
What are we shopping for?
Nothing, I guess. Fernando is the owner, and he hears everything on the river. Maybe he will know something about missionaries.
Chevy emptied his cup into the river and stretched his arms.
Sometimes he has beer for sale. Cerveja.
Nate kept his eyes on the water.
I think we should not buy any, Chevy said, and walked away.
Fine with me, thought Nate.
He drained his cup, sucking down the grounds and grains of sugar.
A cold brown bottle. Perhaps Antarctica or Brahma, the 2 brands he'd already sampled in Brazil. Excellent beer.
A favorite haunt had been a college bar near Georgetown with 120 foreign beers on the menu. He'd tried them all. They served roasted peanuts by the basket and expected you to throw the hulls on the floor. When his pals from law school were in town, they always met at the bar and reminisced about the old days. The beer was ice cold, the peanuts hot and salty, the floor cracked with hulls when you walked, and the girls were young and loose. The place had been there forever, and during each trip through rehab and sobriety, it was the bar Nate missed most. He began to sweat, though the sun was hidden and there was a cool breeze. He buried himself in the hammock and prayed for sleep, a deep, hard coma that would take him past their little stop and into the night. The sweating worsened until his shirt was soaked. He started a book about the demise of the Brazilian Indians, then tried to sleep again. He was wide awake when the engine was throttled down and the boat moved close to the bank. There were voices, then a gentle bump as they docked at the trading post. Nate slowly removed himself from the hammock and returned to the bench where he sat. It was a country store of sorts, built on stilts, a tiny building made of unpainted boards with a tin roof and a narrow porch where, not surprisingly, a couple of locals were lounging with cigarettes and tea. A smaller river circled behind it and disappeared into the Pantanal. A large fuel tank was braced to the side of the building. A flimsy pier jutted into the river to dock the boats. Chevy and Welly eased along the pier carefully because the currents were strong. They chatted with the Pantaneiros on the porch, then went through the open door. Nate had vowed to remain on the boat. He went to the other side of the deck, sat on the opposite bench, stuck his arms and legs through the rail, and watched the full width of the river go by. He would stay up on the deck, on the bench, with his arms and legs locked in the rail. The coldest beer in the world couldn't pull him away. As he had learned, there was no such thing as a short visit in Brazil, especially on the river, where visits were rare. Chevy bought 30 gallons of diesel fuel to replace what had been lost in the storm. The engine started.
Fernando says there is a woman missionary. She works with the Indians.
Chevy handed him a bottle of cold water. They were moving again.
Where?
He's not sure. There are some settlements to the north, near Bolivia. But the Indians don't move on the river, so he doesn't know much about them.
How far is the nearest settlement?
We should be close by morning. But we can't take this boat. We must use the little one.
Sounds like fun.
You remember Marco, the farmer whose cow was killed by our plane?
Sure I do. He had 3 little boys.
Yes, he was there yesterday,
Chevy said, pointing to the store, which was disappearing around a bend.
He comes once a month.
Were the boys with him?
No, he's too dangerous.
What a small world. Nate hoped the boys had spent the money he'd given them for Christmas. He watched the store until it was out of sight. Perhaps on the return leg he'd be well enough to stop and have a cool one. Just a couple, to celebrate their successful journey. He crawled back into the safety of his hammock and cursed himself for his weakness. In the wilderness of a gigantic swamp, he'd had a near brush with alcohol, and for hours his thoughts had been consumed with nothing else. The anticipation, the fear, the sweating, and the scheming of ways to get a drink. Then the near miss, the escape through no strength of his own, and now, in the aftermath, the fantasy of renewing his romance with alcohol. A few drinks would be fine, because then he could stop. That was his favorite lie. He was just a drunk. Run him through a designer rehab clinic at $1,000 a day, and he was still an addict. Run him through AA in the basement of a church on Tuesday nights, and he was still a drunk. His addictions gripped him, and desperation settled around Nate. He was paying for the damned boat. Chevy worked for him. If he insisted that they turn around and go straight to the store, they would do so. He could buy all the beer Fernando owned, load it on ice below the deck, and sip Brahma all the way to Bolivia. And there wasn't a damned thing anyone could do about it. Like a mirage, Welly appeared with a smile and a cup of fresh coffee. "Vou cozinhar," he said. "I'm going to cook." Food would help, Nate thought. Even another platter of beans, rice, and boiled chicken. Food would satisfy his tastes, or at least divert his attention from other cravings. He ate slowly on the upper deck, alone and in the dark, swatting thick mosquitoes away from his face. When he was finished, he sprayed repellent from his neck to his bare feet. The seizure was over. Only slight aftershocks gripped him. He could no longer taste beer or smell the peanuts from his favorite bar. He retreated to his sanctuary. It was raining again, a quiet rain with no wind or thunder. Josh had sent along 4 books for his reading pleasure. All the briefs and memos had been read and reread. Nothing remained but the books. He'd already read half of the thinnest one. He burrowed deep in the hammock and went back to reading the sad history of the native people of Brazil. When the Portuguese explorer Pedro Álvares Cabral first stepped on Brazilian soil on the coast of Bahia in April of 1500, the country had 5 million Indians scattered among 900 tribes. They spoke 1,175 languages, and except for the usual tribal skirmish, they were peaceful people. After centuries of getting themselves civilized by Europeans, the Indian population had been decimated. Only 270,000 survived, in 206 tribes using 170 languages. War, murder, slavery, territorial losses, diseases. No method of exterminating Indians had been neglected by those from civilized cultures. It was a sick and violent history. If the Indians were peaceful and tried to cooperate with the colonists, they were subject to strange diseases, smallpox, measles, yellow fever, influenza, tuberculosis, for which they had no natural defenses. If they did not cooperate, they were slaughtered by men using weapons more sophisticated than arrows and poisoned darts. When they fought back and killed their attackers, they were branded as savages. They were enslaved by miners, ranchers, and rubber barons. They were driven from their ancestral homes by any group with enough guns. They were burned at the stake by priests, hunted by armies and gangs of bandits, raped at will by any able-bodied man with a desire, and slaughtered with impunity. At every point in history, whether crucial or insignificant, when the interests of native Brazilians conflicted with those of white people, the Indians had lost. You lose for 500 years, and you expect little from life. The biggest problem facing some modern-day tribes was the suicide of its young people. After 450 years of genocide, the Brazilian government finally decided it was time to protect its noble savages. Modern-day massacres had brought international condemnation, so bureaucracies were established and laws were passed. With self-righteous fanfare, some tribal lands were returned to the natives and lines were drawn on government maps, declaring them to be safe zones. But the government was also the enemy. In 1967, an investigation into the agency in charge of Indian Affairs shocked most Brazilians. The report revealed that agents, land speculators, and ranchers, thugs who either worked for the agency or had the agency working for them, had been systematically using chemical and bacteriological weapons to wipe out Indians. They issued clothing to the Indians that was infected with smallpox and tuberculosis germs. With airplanes and helicopters, they bombed Indian villages and land with deadly bacteria. And in the Amazon basin and other frontiers, ranchers and miners cared little for lines on maps. In 1986, a rancher in Rondônia used crop dusters to spray nearby Indian land with deadly chemicals. He wanted to farm the land, but first had to eliminate the inhabitants. 30 Indians died, and the rancher was never prosecuted. In 1989, a rancher in Mato Grosso offered rewards to bounty hunters for the ears of murdered Indians. In 1993, gold miners in Manaus attacked a peaceful tribe because they would not leave their land. 13 Indians were murdered, and no one was ever arrested. In the 1990s, the government had aggressively sought to open up the Amazon basin, a land of vast natural resources to the north of the Pantanal. But the Indians were still in the way. The majority of those surviving inhabited the basin. In fact, it was estimated that as many as 50 jungle tribes had been lucky enough to escape contact with civilization. Now, civilization was on the attack again. The abuse of Indians was growing as miners and loggers and ranchers pushed deep into the Amazon with the support of the government. The history was fascinating, if depressing. Nate read for 4 hours nonstop and finished the book. He walked to the wheelhouse and drank coffee with Jevy. The rain had stopped. "Will we be there by morning?" he asked. "I think so." The lights from the boat rocked gently up and down with the current. It seemed as though they were hardly moving. "Do you have any Indian blood?" Nate asked after some hesitation. It was a personal matter, one that in the U.S. no one would dare ask. Jevy smiled without taking his gaze from the river. "All of us have Indian blood. Why do you ask?" "I've been reading the history of Indians in Brazil." "So what do you think?" "It's pretty tragic." "It is. Do you think the Indians have been treated badly here?" "Of course they have." "What about in your country?" For some reason, General Custer was the first thought. At least the Indians had won something. "And we didn't burn them at the stake, or spray them with chemicals, or sell them into slavery." "Did we? What about all those reservations? Land everywhere?" "Not much better, I'm afraid," he said in defeat. It was not a discussion he wanted. After a long silence, Nate eased down to the toilet. When he finished his work there, he pulled the chain above it and left the small room. Light brown river water ran into the toilet bowl and flushed the waste through a tube and sent it directly into the river. Chapter 23. It was still dark when the engine stopped and woke Nate. He touched his left wrist and remembered he wasn't wearing a watch. He listened as Welly and Jevy moved below him. They were at the rear of the boat, talking quietly. He was proud of himself for another sober morning, another clean day for the books. 6 months earlier, every wake-up had been a blur of swollen eyes,
cobwebbed thoughts, seared mouth, arid tongue, bitter breath, and the great daily question of, why did I do it? He often vomited in the shower, sometimes inducing it himself to get it over with. After the shower, there was always the dilemma of what to have for breakfast, something warm and oily to settle the stomach, or perhaps a Bloody Mary to settle the nerves. Then he was off to work, always at his desk by 8, to begin another brutal day as a litigator. Every morning, no exceptions. In the final days of his last crash, he had gone weeks without a clear morning. Out of desperation, he'd seen a counselor, and when asked if he could recall the last day he'd stayed sober, he admitted he could not. He missed the drinking, but not the hangovers. Well, he pulled the John boat to the port side of the Santa Lola and tied it closely. They were loading it when Nate crept down the steps. The adventure was moving into a new phase. Nate was ready for a change of scenery. It was overcast and threatening more rain. The sun finally broke through at about 6. Nate knew because he'd rearmed himself with a watch. A rooster crowed. They were docked near a small farmhouse, their bow tied to a timber that once held a pier. Westward, to their left, a much smaller river met the Paraguay. The challenge was to pack the boat without overloading it. The smaller tributaries they were about to encounter were flooded. Banks would not always be visible. If the boat sat too low in the water, they might run aground, or worse, damage the prop of the outboard. There was only one motor on the John boat, no backup, just a couple of paddles that Nate studied from the deck as he drank his coffee. The paddles would work, he decided, especially if wild Indians or hungry animals were in pursuit. 3 5-gallon gas tanks were arranged neatly in the center of the boat. "These should give us 15 hours," Chevy explained. "That's a long time. I'd rather be safe." "How far away is the settlement?" "I'm not sure." He pointed to the house. "The farmer there said 4 hours.
"Does he know the Indians?"
"No, he doesn't like Indians. Says he never sees them on the river."
Chevy packed a small tent, 2 blankets, 2 mosquito nets, a rain fly for the tent, 2 buckets to dip out rainfall, and his poncho. Well, he added a box of food and a case of bottled water. Seated on his bunk in the cabin, Nate took the copy of the will, the acknowledgement, and the waiver from his briefcase, folded them together, and placed them in a letter-sized envelope. An official Stafford law firm envelope. Since there were no Ziploc bags or garbage liners on board, he wrapped the envelope in a 12-inch square section he cut from the hem of his poncho. He taped the seams with duct tape, and after examining his handiwork, declared his package to be waterproof. Then he taped it to his T-shirt across his chest and covered it with a light denim pullover.